Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama is guaranteed a big audience for a primetime presentation of his plan to fight militants in Iraq and Syria. The big defense contractors are paying attention. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl, and it's great to have you with us here on this, the 10th of September. President Obama makes his case for sustained military action tonight against ISIS, the militant group that now occupies large sections of Syria and Iraq and now controls more territory than many countries. From what we know so far, the plan is for this to cost less than the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
$6 billion more to fight ISIS. That's a number bouncing around in the defense contractor set. To pay for strike aircraft, drones for surveillance, listening to enemy phone calls, and for training rebels. The corporate winners include names you know. Here's Guggenheim Securities analyst Roman Schweitzer.
Boeing and Raytheon make smart munitions. Lockheed Martin or ATK are certainly also in the mix. Northrop Grumman and General Atomics are the two primary drone manufacturers.
For context, this is war on the cheap. Put $6 billion next to a defense and war budget of $560 billion, and you get a rounding error. Or consider the math of Byron Callen at Capital Alpha Partners. Take one laser-guided smart bomb dropped on an ISIS target.
The unit price of those is about $25,000 to $40,000. Now, that's the price of a car, but in the context of companies that may have revenues of anywhere from $25 to $80 billion, you have to drop an awful lot of those to really start making an impact on the bottom line.
The bigger impact may be political. Right now, the tight budget environment, remember the word sequestration, is squeezing all contractors. But now, with a new enemy, the appetite for spending on war could grow, says Yair Reiner of the investment firm Oppenheimer.
With the rise of ISIS, Americans, and I think not just the political class, may be more willing to contemplate intervention.
Further on, winning this fight could mean winning the peace. Soldiers, body protection, armored vehicles, that is real money. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
By the way, if you want to know what $6 billion adds up to, you can head on over to our website. That's marketplace.org. For years now, we've heard complaints that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, will make it tougher for businesses to keep offering health insurance to workers. The argument is that American businesses have to shoulder additional costs. Today, the Kaiser Family Foundation released the results of a big survey, and it gives us a chance to see if those critics were right. From Marketplace's health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports.
Like everybody else, Kaiser Family Foundation's Gary Claxon wanted to know, did the new healthcare law upend employer-based health insurance where 150 million Americans get their coverage?
The first read for 2014 is that the ACA has had no real impact on premiums, nor did it lead to employers not to offer coverage.
You heard right. No ACA-inspired premium spike. Instead, a modest 3% increase. Nearly the same number of employers offering coverage. Nearly the same number of workers enrolling. Bottom line, at least in year one, the ACA has had a small impact on employers, except in one way.
There is no doubt that the Affordable Care Act's exchanges have brought a lot of attention to the concept of retail health insurance.
PricewaterhouseCoopers CeCe Conley says executives see something in the ACA exchanges, where consumers shop. Think Travelocity for health insurance. The consulting firm Accenture predicts private exchange enrollment will top public enrollment by 2018. Rosemary Day with Day Health Strategies says the future of healthcare may be a place where more and more Americans do something that's very difficult to do, become smart healthcare consumers.
That's kind of the notion of exchanges, is that you've got to put something in to get something out. It's not a benefit that's just handed to you.
Day likens this potential shift to when companies moved away from pensions and towards 401k contributions. For workers, that means more choice and more responsibility. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up arrows on all the major indices. Details when we do the numbers. reports of another multi-billion dollar acquisition in the tech sector. This one involves Microsoft and the Swedish company behind the video game Minecraft. That game has sold tens of millions of copies across multiple platforms, the iPhone, Android, PC, Microsoft's Xbox. And now it seems Microsoft is willing to pay at least $2 billion to add their own phone to that list. Joining us now is Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech. Hi, Ben.
Hi, David.
So a basic question here to start, and that is, what does Minecraft have that Microsoft wants?
Well, Mojang, as I understand it's called, the Swedish company that makes Minecraft, has popularity in this game. It's one of the top-selling games on Xbox, the gaming console made by Microsoft, of course. And it has wide appeal, but also kind of has deep appeal. There are a ton of people who play the game, but some of those people are, like, super engaged with the game. A lot of people have used it to try and teach coding to kids, for instance. It's been a success in the publishing world because Scholastic actually publishes books on the game, and they've been big sellers among kids and parents who want their kids to learn basic and advanced computer skills.
Satya Nadella has been the CEO of Microsoft for almost a year now. I think he came on the job in February, and this is really the first big acquisition he's made. You know, telegraph for us a bit what this could mean about the direction he's taken the company in.
Well, it's kind of interesting, right? When Nadella first took the helm, we heard a lot about cloud computing, business software, enterprise, areas where Microsoft is really still pretty important. But like any giant tech company that actually publishes stuff, Microsoft also needs to be sort of diversified. Buying a company that makes a game like Minecraft might help Microsoft sell people on the Windows Phone, for instance. And of course, Minecraft has sold 50 million or more copies, so there's interest, I think, in using it on multiple platforms for players. And that could be a nice little revenue stream for Microsoft. But these sorts of acquisitions can also be tricky, remember, David. And buying games or gaming companies doesn't always pan out for big tech companies.
So that's Nadella. That's the CEO of Microsoft. What about the CEO of this other company, of Mojang? He's a character in his own right. He's a dropout. He worked on Candy Crush. You know, this is a guy who has not been shy about sharing his hatred of big companies like Microsoft.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Marcus Pearson, a.k.a. Notch, has talked actually quite a bit of smack about Microsoft in the past, said that the company's Windows 8 operating system was basically trying to ruin the personal computer as an open platform. He is, you know, a pretty interesting guy. Admittedly, he hasn't worked, as far as we know, on Minecraft really for the past couple of years as the head of the company. But he's an interesting dude. And, you know, even though the company does have some high-profile partnerships with larger companies, it does come as a bit of a surprise that he helped broker this deal.
Bearing that in mind, I mean, how seamlessly do you think that these two companies can work together if this acquisition goes through? You know, what's the culture going to be like bringing this company into Microsoft?
The big question is, how much is Microsoft going to interfere with what this company does? How much can the company sort of continue to do its indie gaming stuff without Microsoft interfering? Now, you remember, of course, Twitch, the video game streaming site, was recently bought by Amazon. And part of the reason that they agreed to be purchased by Amazon was the fact that Amazon basically promised to not mess with their mojo. And I think that's what we see more and more with these kinds of acquisitions. Maybe if Microsoft sort of lets this company continue to exist and do what it does best, it might actually be a pretty sensical partnership, but, you know, I guess that remains in question.
Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, joining us on the line from San Francisco. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, David.
And as Ben said, Minecraft has a partnership with Scholastic. It's also partnered with Lego and some schools. Check out why teachers like Minecraft and what they're doing with it at marketplace.org/learningcurve. A year ago this week, heavy rains brought massive flooding to Colorado's Front Range. One of the places hardest hit was the town of Lyons, about 15 miles north of Boulder. Local officials there say repair costs are expected to hit $100 million. Grace Hood with the station KUNC reports.
Take a walk down Main Street and you barely see signs of last year's flood. But almost everyone in this town of 2,000 has a story.
I mean, we essentially lost nearly 100% of our inventory.
Connie Sullivan owns the deli and grocery store, the St. Vrain Market. The flooding left a foot of mud inside her shop. With destroyed roads, water, and sewer lines, many residents couldn't even return home for 2 months. Sullivan says that put a wrinkle in her recovery plan.
You didn't have electricity, and then you had to figure out when your customer base was going to be returning and what types of products you would be able to sell even once they did return.
One big change? Lyons lost about 20% of its available housing, and Sullivan's business now looks different. Sandwich sales to the increasing number of tourists are up. The town has made a big push to have more people visit and boost sales tax revenue. Grocery sales through Colorado's Food Assistance or Food Stamp program are down.
So we serve that niche of the community, and you know, it's sad to see that those customers are some of the ones that haven't returned.
Those residents have moved to nearby towns like Longmont or Berthoud. Some moved further to other counties, while a few left the state. The reason can be seen in the town's Confluence neighborhood. Nearly every home here is in the midst of repairs or demolition.
You can see this cobble. You can see where the stream was. During the flood, this became really another rivulet.
John O'Brien is the mayor of Lyons. He points to a pile of rocks and debris. It's close to the remains of a home that's expected to be bought by the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program. That's run by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. O'Brien says it's too dangerous for the homeowner to move back.
Because we know when the next flood comes, it's going to come right through here.
In the weeks immediately after the flood, the first priority was to repair downed sewer and water lines. But O'Brien says there are still 87 projects the town needs to complete, work that includes repairing parks, streams, and bridges.
It's not really a sprint. This is a marathon for recovery.
Molly Urbina is Colorado's chief recovery officer. A year after the flooding, she says communities are still rebuilding, especially in three of the hardest hit counties that include Lyons and Boulder County. Even though federal and state agencies have pumped millions into repairs, Urbina says there will still be a shortfall for some.
There was way more damage than there is going to be for grant funding. So the local communities have to look at what their own budgets and see how this all fits. You know, what's the gap and how do we get there?
That gap in Boulder County is expected to be $56 million. To soften the financial blow, the county's asking voters to approve a special flood sales and use tax this November.
We'll be concerned with replacing the housing that we lost, that 20%, which was substantially damaged.
And while there's a long list of repairs ahead, Lyons Mayor John O'Brien says a key concern is the lack of affordable housing. The town lost both of its two trailer parks, which held about 50 homes.
It's going to be difficult. I mean, because Lyons is the last best place in Boulder County, it means that housing values continue to rise.
The details of when, where, and how to build affordable housing will be discussed in the coming months. But completing the project will take years. O'Brien says flood recovery won't be complete until everyone who wants to move back to Lyons can return home. I'm Grace Hood for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's kind of fun. It's like the electric car. You know, it's almost a race to come up with the method or the model that really works well.
The future of agriculture may be in something called aquaponics. Aquaponics. But first, let's do the numbers. Bit of a bounce back on hump day as Wall Street reversed 2 days of losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average traded up 54 points, nearly a third of a percent, close at 17,068. The NASDAQ jumped 34 points, three quarters of a percent, to finish at 4,586. And the S&P 500 rose 7 points, more than a third percent, to end the day at 1,995. Not much in the way of corporate news, but there is this update on the ongoing saga of would-be dollar store mergers. Shares in Dollar General were up nearly 0.5% after the company said today it will try a hostile takeover of Family Dollar. Family Dollar shares up 0.2% on the day. In Europe, France's CAC 40 and Britain's FTSE were pretty much both flat, while Germany's DAX dipped 0.1%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei bumped up 0.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday, September 11th. It's the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. We arrive at the end of the catwalk in New York. Fashion Week wraps up. And 40 years ago, the television series Little House on the Prairie premiered. It ran for 9 seasons. A lot of drama in Walnut Grove. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. How about that quiet, understated affair in Cupertino, California yesterday, at which Apple rolled out a wristwatch and a couple new iPhones? Well, it didn't take long before there was a flurry of new phone plans from carriers hoping you'll use the iPhone 6 on their networks. Here's Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson.
The Apple Store at Grand Central is relatively busy. After an event like the iPhone 6 launch yesterday, there are lots of people interested in a shiny new phone. And American cell phone carriers are hoping to jump on that.
The carriers are really looking to take advantage of, you know, the marketing blitz that comes with a new Apple product. So they're all kind of looking to try and come out with some sort of a catch that's going to really grab a consumer's attention.
Weston Hendrick with NPD Group says Sprint is being particularly aggressive, knocking $10 a month off the price of its unlimited plan or giving customers the option to lease the phone. Basically, it's a dog-eat-dog world for carriers right now, says Ramon Lamas, the research manager for IDC's mobile phone team.
Mobile phone subscriber growth is leveling off, and without much more new green space to grow into, it's a game of, how do we steal customers from the other guy?
Following a move by T-Mobile a few years back, many companies are dropping contracts that lock up customers for a couple years. They're also increasingly abandoning the subsidies that heavily discount the phone, but tend to come with higher monthly fees, says Colin Gibbs with GigaOhm Research.
The cost of service has been kind of separated from the cost of a handset. Not entirely. Verizon, for instance, still leans heavily on subsidized handsets, but that's certainly the trend.
Bottom line, if you want the new iPhone, there's lots of companies competing to sell it to you. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
And check out a list of all the ways phone companies are trying to get your business. That is at marketplace.org. The financial crisis ended, banks have pulled in record profits, and this last quarter was one of the most profitable in history. But less and less of that money is coming from fees. There's two reasons for that. One is new Fed rules put in place in 2010 that made it harder for banks to impose fees on consumers. And the other reason is we've changed the way we bank after a few tough years. Conrad Wilson reports.
The commercial banking industry made $32.5 billion in fees last year, according to data from the FDIC.
The banks are making lots of money on their fees, but it's significantly less than it was a handful of years ago.
Jefferson Harrelson is the Associate Director of Research at the investment banking firm Keefe, Bruyette & Woods. And he's right. In 2009, banks made almost $8 billion more in fees. Harrelson says financial regulation played a big role.
There's been new rules to limit the number of bounce checks. There's been new rules to limit when you bounce a check. If you go slightly below zero, that you don't bounce now.
Banks also don't charge as much for debit card transactions these days. But not everyone agrees that banks are making that much less.
The perception is there's been this massive decline in service charges. I don't think that's been the case. I think the growth has slowed down.
Christopher Marniak is a research analyst at Fig Partners.
What's happening is the banks are finding other ways to make fee income.
Analysts say that's why some banks have scaled back on things like free checking accounts. Richard Hunt is CEO of the Consumer Banking Association. He argues some financial regulation was needed, but says Congress went too far when it decided how much banks can charge for services.
Yes, we're in the business of making money. Yes, we should charge for our services as long as it is reasonable and transparent.
In other words, bank fees are here to stay. I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
The future of agriculture could be in something called aquaponics. That's catching on in Minnesota. Vegetable plants filter water for tropical fish, and those tropical fish fertilize the vegetable plants. The challenge now is figuring out if it can work on a commercial scale. Chris Julin has the story.
This is the kitchen at Lake Avenue Restaurant. It's about a block from Lake Superior in the touristy district of Duluth.
This is a curly lettuce, and then this is a type of romaine.
Tony Barron's the executive chef. The salad greens he's holding were grown just down the road.
They're beautiful. They come to us clean because it's grown aquaponically instead of in dirt, which is wonderful. In the kitchen, it's less labor for us.
Barron serves locally grown lettuce all year round. And that's tricky in these parts. Last winter, the temperature was below zero 23 days in a row. But in here, it's always warm. This is where that lettuce came from. It's the greenhouse at Victus Farms. It's about an hour's drive from Duluth in a little mining town called Silver Bay.
And these are all our babies.
Mike Mayzew's checking out his lettuce crop. He runs the place. He's an unlikely-looking farmer. He's wearing cargo shorts and a backwards ball cap, and he's barefoot. He's an unlikely-looking professor, too, but that's his job, professor of geography at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He runs a program in environment and sustainability, and this indoor farm is a research project. Universities and private businesses across the country are experimenting with aquaponics.
It's kind of fun. It's like the electric car. You know, it's almost a race to come up with the method or the model that really works well.
Most of Mayzew's lettuce is floating. Each plant is stuck in a hole in an inch and a half thick sheet of polystyrene foam. The foam rafts float in pools in the greenhouse, and the lettuce roots dangle through the foam into the water. The fish live in a neighboring room.
So these guys are 3 weeks old, 4 weeks old, five weeks old.
Tilapia are swimming in 9 plastic tanks. Each tank's about 6 feet tall, maybe 12 feet across. Waste from the fish gets pumped over to fertilize the plants in the greenhouse, and some of the pools in the greenhouse grow algae and duckweed that come back into this room to feed the fish. That's aquaponics.
Which means you grow fish and plants sort of in concert, one living off the other.
This is Victus Farm's second year, and it's selling all the fish and vegetables it can produce. Now the goal is to get more efficient. Here's an idea they got online and refined for 6 months. They built floor-to-ceiling racks made of PVC pipe. On the horizontal pipes, they drilled holes in the top and stuck a plant in each hole. And then they run water rich with nutrients through the pipes.
And so it's just all trial and error, you know. I wonder if we can grow tomatoes in 4-inch pipe. Yes, you try it and it works. I mean, look at these tomatoes. There's millions of them.
Mayzew's banking on this vertical gardening system for the future. It'll let them make use of some of the empty vertical space. And it'll let them move the fish into the ponds in the greenhouse.
Then we can grow probably 10 times the plants per unit surface area, which means our greenhouse only needs to be a tenth the size. And what we'd like to do is come up with a really efficient, cheap, small facility. And every small town could have one or two or three of them. And so the food could really be literally produced in the backyard of the restaurants or whatever.
This place cost about $2 million to put together, but Mayzew thinks a self-sustaining version could be built for a whole lot less in someone's yard. So they're going to find out. This is Baylor Radke's house. He's second in command at Victus Farms. This summer, he and Mayzew cleared some trees from Radke's yard. They put up their own money to build a much smaller and simpler fish and vegetable operation. Radke says they'll be up and running this fall.
The whole point of it is to allow people to grow as much as we did in that $2 million facility in a facility that costs under $100,000.
Way under $100,000. Radke and Mayzew have done the math. This place will cost them $20,000 to build because they're doing all the labor. They figure they'll bring in $50,000 in the first year from a building the size of a 4-car garage. And if it works in northern Minnesota, they say, imagine how well it could work in a warm place like Iowa. This is Chris Juland for Marketplace.
Chris, by the way, is with Burn, an energy journal produced by Sound Vision Productions, supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note about those pictures of Jennifer Lawrence and Kate Upton that wound up on the web last week, photos that were stolen from those celebrities' iCloud accounts. Well, links to those pictures showed up on Reddit, and Wired reports in just 6 days, the site earned enough money to power its servers for roughly a month. That was through the sale of memberships. It's likely the site made even more money off of ads. Wired says those photos led to a 250 million page views on Reddit. That is, in the full week it took for the site to ban them. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow traded up 54 points, nearly a third of a percent, to close at 17,068. The NASDAQ jumped 34 points, and the S&P 500 rose 7 points, more than a third percent, to end the day at 1995. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm David Gura. Marketplace is back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.